Well, I mean, it should scare you because it's scary. But at the same time, what is scary? What is scary? Is the world going to end? Is there going to be a giant tornado that sucks us all up into outer space and dumps us off on another planet?
Hello, and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Zachary Wheeler, and today I'm joined with Megan Rutkai and Franz Osilia. Today's episode is the second installment in POFA Season 2. Today, we'll be discussing a critically important issue, climate change. What is climate change? How will it affect our lives? And how has the international community responded to its threat? Specifically, we'll focus discussion around the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015. To help us answer these questions, we have on the podcast today Professor Bentley Allen. Bentley Allen is an assistant professor of political science and an affiliate of the Environment, Energy, Sustainability, and Health Institute at Johns Hopkins University. He has research interests in history and theory of the international order, global environmental politics, and the role of science and expertise in global politics. Thank you for joining us today, Professor.
No, thank you for having me, and thank you for devoting time to this very important issue.
Of course. We hope everyone enjoys this episode.
Yes.
Professor Allen, could you briefly describe what climate change is and how it might affect the world as we know it?
So the central problem of climate change is a group of greenhouse gases, mainly CO2, carbon dioxide, but also methane and a few other greenhouse gases that were especially potent. And these greenhouse gases enter the atmosphere as emissions, as a byproduct from industrial activity and basically all global energy use. Those greenhouse gases create what is called radiative forcing in the atmosphere, which is the scientific term for the fact that it makes the atmosphere warm up. And as the atmosphere warms up, we see sea level rise, melting ice, melting glaciers, increased precipitation in some areas, drought in other areas, extreme weather events, increase the reproduction rates of various bugs and animals change, the zones of reproduction change for bugs and animals and plants and everything else too. So basically it affects every single thing in the world. And one way to think about it in the long-term historical perspective is to think that we as humans built everything that you see in the world around us during this nice warm period called the Holocene period. Now, it was warm, that is, it wasn't the Ice Age, but it was just warm enough. And we're making it too warm, essentially, for all of the conditions of human life and human civilization that have evolved during that Holocene period. So it's going to affect everything, and we're jolting ourselves out of this nice little warm band called the Holocene into something that geologists and others have called the Anthropocene, which shows us that humans, the anthro, has entered in as a geological force that is affecting weather and climate on a massive scale.
Well, thank you, Professor, for that analysis of what exactly climate change is. Could you give us maybe a brief overview of past efforts in global climate governance? What exactly does global climate governance mean?
Sure. So the climate was first really turned into a problem, let's say, in the 1970s and 80s as global modeling efforts got more sophisticated and they were able to finally make a conclusive prediction that more CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere were going to actually definitively cause warming. So it really became a problem in the 1980s, and efforts to deal with the climate started back then. The first institutions for dealing with climate change were created in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. And the first major institution was the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was signed in 1992. And that's just a negotiating forum. It doesn't have any legally binding commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in that particular convention treaty. It's basically just a mechanism that we use to get states together so that they would hammer out an actual treaty.
And going along those guidelines, could you please give a description about the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change as well as the Kyoto Protocol as well?
Sure. So the Kyoto Protocol was signed in 1997. So the UNFCC, the UN Framework Convention, was signed in 92, as I said. And then in 97, they actually generated the Kyoto Protocol, which was a treaty that did have some binding elements to it. And under that Kyoto Protocol, states in Annex 1, these are developed countries, rich countries, they would actually make commitments to reduce their emissions. And the developing countries or poor countries were in what was called Annex II, and they didn't have to make commitments, but they were still involved through something called the Clean Development Mechanism, which provided funds from rich countries to do projects in those developing countries that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And then the countries in Annex I or the rich countries would get credit towards their emissions reductions for engaging in those products. The Kyoto Protocol also had something that was called a market mechanism, and that market mechanism was basically that Kyoto was arranged as a big cap and trade. And basically what that meant is there was going to be a global cap on emissions. All the countries were going to fit their personal commitments within that larger global cap. And then if they went underneath their own country goal, they could trade the excess emissions reductions credits to other states. And that was supposed to create a market for global carbon. But each country was left to decide how they were going to implement climate change policies within their own country. That was left up to the individual states. They could just do what they wanted on that. But they had to meet these goals that they pledged that they would make. And then there was this mechanism to try to make sure it was all enforced and brought together under the global cap.
And so do you think the Kyoto Protocol was effective in beginning to curb climate? I mean, obviously, effective is a moving goalpost, but I mean, what did you think? Did the Kyoto Protocol do a good job, or where are we at now?
Well, I think the consensus is that the Kyoto Protocol was a massive failure. and I think everybody knew that relatively early on in the commitment period that Kyoto was supposed to govern, right? So Kyoto went into effect in the early 2000s, and already by then, the U.S. had pulled out of it. And even though they kept going with the Kyoto Protocol, it was quite clear that it was not going to do what everybody thought needed to be done, which is, you know, transition global energy production away from fossil fuels and towards renewables and alternatives. It was quite clear, you know, only a few years into the Kyoto Protocol that wasn't going to happen. The question was whether or not Kyoto would have enough of an effect to get the ball rolling. And I think we could have a debate about that. But it's clear that, you know, not enough has been done.
Interesting. All right. Thank you, Professor.
So what makes the Paris Climate Agreement so different from past global climate governance protocols?
So there's the optimistic way to put that, and there's the pessimistic way to put that, right? Which one do you want first? The optimistic way is to say, look, Kyoto had failed. It had reached an impasse. Global negotiations were not going well. And the Paris Agreement was rightfully seen and hailed as a breakthrough. It was a breakthrough on a couple of counts. Number one, it eliminated this distinction between Annex I and Annex II, which had held up negotiations and had made a lot of political problems. Basically, what that meant effectively is that China and Brazil and others now recognized that they needed to make something like a tangible commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So those countries stepped out of Annex II and into the group of states making commitments. In the case of China, they didn't say, we're going to reduce our emissions by X percentage, which is what all the rich countries did under Kyoto. But they did say that they were going to peak emissions, you know, by a certain date, and that they were going to have carbon intensity targets. So a certain percentage of their energy was going to be produced by renewable energies, et cetera, et cetera. So they stepped up and they made some commitments under Paris. So in that sense, it was a breakthrough. It eliminated this old distinction. It showed that all the major economies were back on board for trying to reboot some kind of global treaty to address climate change. And that's the optimistic interpretation. The pessimistic interpretation is that basically what Paris is a pledge and review system. Now, a pledge and review system basically says, look, we're all going to make our own individual commitments, and then we're going to create a spreadsheet, we're gonna add them all up, and we're gonna see what kind of emissions reductions we've got at the end of that. And if it adds up to significant coverage, great. If it doesn't add up to a significant reduction, well, we're gonna do this review thing where we talk to each other and try to convince some members of the group to add more into the pile. Okay, now that doesn't sound incredibly complicated, because it's not that complicated. And you probably won't be surprised to learn that this, of course, had been proposed before. Why don't we just have a pledge and review system? So pledge and review was first floated back in the early 1990s, so before the UNFCCC, before the Kyoto Protocol. And it was laughed out of the room back then because it wasn't ambitious enough. So we're basically back to the future, right? We are back to the bottom worst case scenario for what a global treaty would look like, which was first floated 25 years before Paris was signed. So in that sense, on the pessimistic interpretation, the Paris Agreement doesn't look all that promising. On the optimistic interpretation, well, it's a hell of a lot better than what we had in 2009, which was absolutely nothing. So, like I said, there's two ways to look at it.
Interesting. Well, Professor, I think something interesting is discussing what's the motivation for individual countries to actually follow through with those voluntary pledges? Like, why is the United States, well, not the United States, bad example. why do countries do this? What's their goal?
Well, I think avoiding climate catastrophe is probably, on the head of their minds. I mean, the other optimistic thing that happened in Paris was that under Kyoto and under earlier negotiations on climate, the target had been we don't want to exceed 2 degrees of warming. And as the science comes in, we start to realize, well, even 2 degrees of warming would be pretty bad. So maybe we should make the target 1.5. And countries signed on to a relatively weak statement, something like, it would be good if we could keep it to 1.5 or something like that, right? It wasn't saying like we have to meet 1.5 and we're going to meet 1.5. It wasn't that strong. But at least 1.5 got on the document instead of 2. So why do countries want to meet their agreements? Well, let's look at the countries who actually have done a lot. I mean, let's look at Germany. What motivates them? Well, there's a couple things. Again, we could take a pessimistic or an optimistic interpretation, or maybe a moralistic and a realistic perspective, depending on how you look at it. But maybe the optimistic or moralistic reason would be to say, look, Germany realizes that this is a significant problem, and you're not going to get progress on a significant global problem unless somebody leads. And the EU has stepped up. The Scandinavian countries, Sweden has a carbon tax. It's like $120 per ton, which is big compared to other pricing initiatives, which are closer to $20 or $30. So it has a huge carbon tax. Other European countries have done similar initiatives. Germany put a lot of money into alternative energy between 2000 and 2010. And they didn't do that because they thought, this is going to be a good move for our economy. They did that because they thought this was going to be an important thing. Now, why is Europe generally more inclined to make hard climate change commitments than, say, the U.S.? Well, they don't have a giant shale gas economy. They don't have a history of pulling a lot of oil out of the ground. So energy has always been kind of expensive, and not just expensive, but geopolitically risky in Europe, which is to say that, a large percentage of European natural gas comes from Russia. And every time Russia and Europe gets into a fight, Russia's like, we're going to turn the gas off. And then Europe is like, oh, no,
it's a good way to
we're not. Yeah, so exactly. So it would be good if we were on solar, because then they wouldn't be able to use that. Right. And that's why you see like liquefied natural gas leaving the United States and going to Europe. Why Europeans are very interested in setting up ports in Europe to receive liquefied natural gas from the United States, because they'd like to diversify their fossil fuel supply. A little bit off topic now, but I think the point here is that Europe has a vested geopolitical and economic interest in reducing its reliance on fossil fuels that is made easier by a historical conservation that was imposed on them by high prices because they were getting it from somewhere else. The United States, on the other hand, look, it's a big country. It has bad interstate infrastructure. And you can't take a train from Arizona to New York, right? Whereas you can from, Paris to Berlin, or from Paris to the UK or whatever. Yeah, well, we can talk about Elon Musk later as sort of an interesting piece of this overall project, right? But also, the U.S. has this domestic fossil fuel industry, right? And what does that domestic fossil fuel industry do? Well, number one, it empowers large corporations who have a vested economic interest in lobbying the government to, pretend that it's not a problem. So that's clearly been happening since the early 90s as well, right? But also, it means that the way the whole energy infrastructure of the country is set up, it's all premised on cheap coal, right? So we live in Baltimore. Many of our listeners will probably be students who live in these houses that were built in the 19th century. And these houses are absurd. Like, you might notice, like, if you stand in one of these bay windows on these row homes in Baltimore, you're freezing cold. Why? Well, there's no insulation in the bays. There's no insulation in the front or the back of the house, which isn't brick, right? So the reason why? Well, because all these things were heated by coal, and all you needed to do was shove this extremely cheap rock into a furnace in the bottom of the house, and it would heat the whole thing, and you just stay away from the windows. And even now, that carries through to, like, you know, well, we have more efficient furnaces than we used to, and we don't put rocks of coal in them directly. But the houses are just set up to be extremely wasteful, whereas in Europe, they're not. They're insulated, and, you know, the windows on most buildings are relatively new, and they did all that because energy was expensive. So if energy's cheap, you set your country up to basically use a lot of it and require a lot of it, and if energy is, you know, expensive, you set things up in a different way. So there are those fundamental structural factors that I think make Europe and the United States very different, but also Europe has just shown time and time again that it's willing to be a leader on issues that are hard to get cooperation on, that they're willing to take the first steps on development or, you know, financial reform or whatever. They're willing to take these steps to lead on various, you know, moral issues as they see them to try to catalyze economic cooperation, you know, cooperation on climate change, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the EU itself is evidence of that history.
And domestic activism has also played an important role in the development of more climate laws and more climate initiatives as well. Could you speak a little bit more about that as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could also talk about that. I mean, the Green parties historically in Europe have been stronger, and because they have parliamentary systems where, you know, you don't need as high a percentage of the vote in order to get a voice in governments, you know, that has changed a lot. So activists can more directly and more easily shape the policy of the major parties in Europe in ways that are harder in the United States, and you don't have as robust of a homegrown environmental movement in the United States as you do in Europe. But obviously that's something that a lot of organizations here are trying to change. The problem in the United States is not a lack of activism, right? The problem is that they're up against
money
and lots of money. And I think if you look at the ballot initiatives on renewable energy from the midterms, you know, that's very clear. You know, there were all these ballot initiatives that did quite well, but they were just up against a lot of coal money. And, mm-hmm. you know, that makes those things difficult.
So, Professor Allen, one of the biggest issues in international agreements is cheating, whether that is secretly building centrifuges to enrich uranium or circumnavigating the Versailles Treaty by testing military equipment in Russia. Countries that have an interest and ability in cheating on international agreements tend to do so. What is preventing countries from pulling a global Volkswagen? Could countries misreport on their NDC reports, in effect cheating?
So this is obviously a big big issue in the negotiations that happen in these UNFCC negotiations. So this is usually discussed under the auspices of technical terms like monitoring and verification. And basically just what we mean is, you know, countries have to report what they're doing, and they have to do so in a transparent manner. And then they have to be checked as to whether or not they're actually living up to the things that they say they're going to live up to. This is, of course, for some countries anyway, interpreted as being, you know, a violation of sovereignty or something like that. Like, we don't want, you know, international bureaucrats messing around in our financial accounts to see how much coal we burned and, you know, whether or not we actually put as much money into clean investment as we said we were going to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this becomes an issue in the negotiations. The other issue is capacity. You know, you need bureaucrats in order to keep these statistics. You need bureaucrats in order to report to the UNFCC. So a lot of developing countries that don't necessarily have, you know, a giant State Department or whatever would say, look, these reporting requirements put an undue burden on us and we need more flexibility. And all these are issues that come up in the negotiations again and again and again and again. But the fact of the matter is that I'm not sure that there's a political, technical, bureaucratic, or institutional solution to these things. I think the question is, you know, states, are they committed to solving this problem collectively or not? If states are committed to solving this problem collectively, then they won't cheat because they want to avoid the disastrous outcome. Now, in political science, we say that just creates a collective action problem, right? Everybody wants there to be an agreement. Everybody wants collective action. But every country wants to be the one country that's not doing anything. Every country wants to be the one country that is cheating. We want everybody else to comply, but we would like to cheat. So there's these incentives are kind of built into the issue. And, you know, the idea is that there's going to be an institutional or technical solution, right? Like a system of independent third-party monitoring and verification that would take care of all this. But, the fact of the matter is that how do we know how much coal is being burned in China? How are we going to figure that out? We can sit on the outside and do like some back of the envelope calculations based on, you know, overall industrial output. And we can compare that to the industrial output of other countries. And we can say, well, they have to be burning about this much coal and that's going to produce this amount of greenhouse gases and blah, 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 blah. So we could do that third party outside estimate. But at the end of the day, the uncertainty bands on that estimate are going to be wide enough that, you know, it's not clear that we would have a precise picture of exactly what's going on inside these countries. So the regime is dependent on honest reporting in a way. And the key is, can we make that reporting transparent enough that it would be really complicated for those states to cheat so that they just don't bother? The other thing to think about, too, is that, you know, why would they cheat? These pledges they're making are completely voluntary. They're supposed to be making politically designed pledges that are going to be easy for them to keep. Why would they make a pledge that they wouldn't care about? And this gets right to the heart of the question of all international agreements. Of course, states could violate every single international agreement, but if they did violate every single international agreement, then the whole edifice would collapse. And that is to say, global governance and international law are premised upon everybody cooperating and everybody doing it together. And as long as the system seems to be benefiting everyone overall, states tend to treat those treaty obligations that they take on relatively seriously. And so, again, I think we could get bogged down in talking about cheating and all that. But really, right, what we really care about is whether or not states are politically committed to solving the problem or not.
And that said, would you say that, A, the United States is not politically committed to resolving the problem since they pulled out of the agreement? Or what other issues
intend,
might be
intend to?
Yes, that's the correct terminology. Or what other issues are driving the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords?
Well, I mean, I think we could have an entire podcast on what the hell is going on inside the Republican Party. Yeah. But I mean, that's really what it fundamentally comes down to. Like, we have this tendency to speak of countries as if they're like monolithic things, right? So the German position is X and the French position is X and the American position is Y. But, you know, we know that within the United States, this battle is happening right now, right? So is the U.S. as a whole committed? Of course not. Obviously, there isn't the level of political commitment in this country. But it depends on who you focus on. Like, if you just look at straight polls, you know, 60, 65% of Americans think that climate change is an important problem that should be dealt with. It's a bipartisan issue if you just look at polling, right? But the fact of the matter is that, you know, fossil fuel money has the Republican Party in its pocket, and we're not going to get robust cooperation on that until the Republicans find that it's electorally damaging for them to be ignoring the problem. I mean, obviously other countries don't think that the U.S. is committed, but that hasn't stopped them from going ahead and basically... Mm-hmm.
Doing it
without the United States. And this is a general pattern we're seeing across global governance problems at the moment.
But so the Kyoto Protocol in 2001, the Bush administration pulled out, and that some would argue that is what doomed the Kyoto Protocol in the first place, is because the United States wasn't there. Why is it different in Paris? You know, how is it that Paris can continue on without the United States versus in Kyoto it was not possible?
Well, I don't think that Paris can be successful without the United States. I think what everybody is hoping is that the Trump administration will be seen as an aberration, and that I think the international climate community, you know, hopes for a different outcome in 2020 than in 2016, and then, you know, the return of a Democratic presidency would see the renewal of American leadership on climate change. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that it was American leadership on climate change that made the Paris Agreement happen. Without the cooperation between the U.S. and China in 2015 in the lead up to Paris, you wouldn't have had the Paris Agreement. And so that special personal relationship between Obama and Xi, that was essential to cooperation then, and one would hope that an American president that was, you know, more committed to the problem would be able to jump right back in. The fact of the matter is that Paris is a gambit. It's a gambit, which is that the domestic politics of this will resolve the issue, which is to say that the first movers on global energy, Germany and China, let's just say for the sake of simplification, countries that poured a lot of money into renewables between 2000 and 2010, note that the United States is not on that list. Those countries got a good first mover advantage. Both their renewables industries look well positioned to capture a lot of global market share in the coming decades. And I think the gambit of Paris is that the technological side of the equation is basically solving the problem, and that the United States can do whatever it wants for the next 4 years. But guess what? The prices of solar vis-a-vis coal are continuing to fall, and you know, we're real close to basically renewables being competitive with fossil fuels without government support for those policies. And we don't really need U.S. leadership because basically the global investor climate has taken care of the problem. Now, that's the again, that's the optimistic view, right, that American leadership is not essential to this. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, getting back to the political commitment problem, you know, the technological solution without a political commitment would seem to me to be that's a bad bet. I wouldn't bet on a successful transition away from fossil fuels without the political side being taken care of. And you do need leadership on that side. So I think we do need the U.S. to come back into the fold as a leader at some point soon. But, you know, the next 4 years wouldn't be the end of the world as long as progress on the technological and business side continues.
So in terms of sort of, you know, that hard action, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report published in October of this year stated that limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is possible within the laws of chemistry and physics, but doing so would require unprecedented changes. So what kinds of unprecedented changes would need to be seen in order to reach this goal?
So we could sit down and we could make a long list of things that we could all do to make climate change less of a problem, right? Renewables are the big part of the picture, but there's a lot of other stuff that needs to happen too. There needs to be changes in the way that land is used through agriculture and things like that. There needs to be changes to public transportation infrastructures. There needs to be carbon capture and storage. There needs to be all kinds of stuff that's happening that isn't currently happening, right? And basically what the IPCC report says is we got 20 years to get our act together or we're in big trouble. And what they mean by big trouble is that basically once we have 1.5 degrees of warming on in the atmosphere, that we're going to start to see, you know, some really negative consequences on each of those variables I mentioned before. So extreme weather events, sea level rise, flooding of cities, flooding of agricultural plots, irreversible changes to the Arctic that will, feed further climate change and make the situation even worse, even if we don't put any more fossil fuels, things like that. So they basically say we got 20 years to basically get to zero emissions or we're going to be in big trouble. So the unprecedented changes is this extremely long list of stuff. And if you look at the IPCC report, basically they got a list of these 20 things that need to happen. And in scenario one, you know, we do those 20 things really fast and we get to zero emissions, at a reasonably comfortable way in 20, 25 years. And in scenario two, we only do half of them and we don't quite make it. And then in scenario three, we don't do enough of them. But basically the way that they bail us out is through carbon capture and storage. So the IPCC report basically says, like, if we don't do a lot of stuff really fast, we're gonna need to extract carbon from the atmosphere. And I guess that's what they mean when they say that it's, you know, possible within the laws of chemistry. It is, of course, possible that we could extract lots of carbon really rapidly from the atmosphere. But, you know, when I first started studying the issue, you know, 15 years ago, Craig Venter was like, oh, I'm going to invent an algae that will, like, take CO2 out of the atmosphere at really rapid rates. And this was something that was, like, going to happen now, 15 years ago, and we haven't gotten there yet. So actually removing large amounts of carbon is something that physicists are always like, oh yeah, you should be able to do it, because they can do a back of the envelope calculation and be like, yeah, we should be able to remove that much carbon. But practically developing the infrastructure and the technology and the genetic engineering and whatever else has to go into that is a lot more complicated than that. So yeah, it's possible, but is it going to happen? No. We're going to go over 1.5 degrees. So the question is, are we politically ready for living in that world? I guess that's the question that is now on the table from the 1.5C IPCC report. It's not are we going to be able to do that? Like, no self-respecting political scientists will sit here on this side of the mic and be like, yeah, we're going to make it. Don't worry. Everything's going to be okay. But at the same time,
You're scaring us, prof.
Well, I mean, it should scare you because it's scary. But at the same time, what is scary? What is scary? Is the world going to end? Is there going to be a giant tornado that sucks us all up into outer space and dumps us off on another planet? No, it's not going to be like a movie where we get to clearly and tangibly see that there's this event that happens that catalyzes action. That's the kicker, right? Professor Dudney has a new paper out where he talks about, you know, nuclear war and it's all very scary and whatnot. And he says, you know, the silver lining is, he's like, basically nuclear war is going to happen sometime in the next generation or two. Okay, this is almost inevitable. The silver lining is that on the other end of that nuclear war, we'll have the political capacity and the political motivation to deal with the problem in a way that we should have dealt with it after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okay. Now, you could hope for a similar kind of event in climate change. Okay. There's going to be some big thing that happens that makes everybody pay attention and finally buckle down and get to it. That's not going to happen. What's going to happen is, and this is what the IPCC report says, we're going to put 700 million people in poverty over the next 50 to 100 years, which means we're going to erase the gains of economic growth that we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years. We're going to have more refugees from climate and natural disaster, climate-related natural disasters, right? We're going to exacerbate the refugee and migration problem that right now we have 65 million refugees and internally displaced people on the planet, which is the highest number since World War II. We're going to make that problem worse. So how is climate change going to manifest itself? How is climate catastrophe, like this language, like catastrophe, it's supposed to conjure up this motivational image in our minds of like a nuclear explosion. Well, that's not going to happen. What climate catastrophe looks like is the worsening of the present tensions within global order. Those are going to get worse and worse and worse every year, and we're not going to know that they're climate related because there's no special tag on a hurricane that says, oh, this one was climate related, but the last one, that was just like a normal one. There's no tag on a mudslide in Asia that puts 100,000 people out of their village, out of their towns and villages, and there's no tag on a flood that destroys the crop for a specific important crucial harvest in Bangladesh. Like that, there's no tag on that, right? That just looks like the worsening of global conditions that are already bad. So the question is, do we have political institutions that are ready for living in a world where this sort of stuff becomes routine, but it doesn't necessarily appear to us as climate change? Okay.
Wow. Very ominous.
That makes me ask the question. Like,
brings me back to GSP.
Yes. No, that makes me ask the question. I mean, climate, having good environment is a public good. And it requires that every nation commits to this, you know, ambiguous goal of 1.5 reductions in the next 20 years. That to me seems very, like, not likely to happen. So should we be preparing ourselves for what should, like, for example, Florida should be preparing itself for the rising sea levels that are going to occur in the next 20 years? Or should islands in the Pacific should be preparing themselves for extension, I guess?
Yes and yes. There, I answered a question with two words.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Well, okay, so first of all, on the Florida question, I mean, that's already happening, yeah. Right? This is getting priced into insurance markets, for example, which just won't insure houses that are on the shore. So, you know, again, you know, America is supposed to be the country in which market rationality is the paragon of decision making. And the market is making this decision already, but the political elites are not. So that's clearly already happening. Folks in your generation shouldn't buy property without looking at flood maps for the region, like just little things like that. You think about owning a house for 30 years. Well, you know what? The topography of this country is going to change a lot in the next 30 years. You know, I think those are important things to think about. And certainly certain countries have to prepare themselves for extinction. And again, that's even an abstract way of putting it. Like, let's talk about changes not just to people having to leave their homes, which is going to become a major problem, but but actually the elimination of human diversity through the fact that people are losing their livelihoods in a way that we couldn't have anticipated. Little things like my colleague here, Professor Khan in the anthropology department is studying, you know, Bangladeshi people who have lived, you know, in these riverbeds down by the shore, and their entire way of life is premised upon, you know, their relationship to the water, and that relationship is changing. So their entire way of life is changing. The cultural norms, the way that they understand the world, their cosmologies, those are all being challenged by climate change, and we're sort of forcing through all kinds of social changes in addition to all those economic and political changes, right? You can also think about things like olive groves in Italy. You know, there are pests that are now able to reproduce that are making a major dent on olive oil harvests or olive harvests in Tuscany. And like olives have been the cradle of civilization there for, you know, millennia. And we're basically taking these valleys, which have been home to a certain form of tree, a certain way of life for millennia, and we're basically making it so that that can't be the case anymore. So it's not just that people are going to have to be moved, that there's going to be political and economic costs, but there's a real cultural and human cost to those things as well. And all of that is going to happen. And I guess, I mean, one way to get at the issue that is kind of fundamentally underlying our discussion here is like, should you be freaking out or whatever, right? And my wife asks me this kind of question all the time, and she's inclined to freak out a little bit. So, you know, I'm sort of constantly having this conversation. And the answer is, of course, yes, you should freak out. But you shouldn't freak out because something totally radically different from your everyday life right now is going to happen, right? I mean, we are all relatively in a privileged position, you know, geopolitically, economically, racially.
The fact that we're sitting and doing this podcast today.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all that puts us in a privileged position. And you know what? Like, the world is pretty good at maintaining people in privileged positions in those privileged positions. So it's not like it's going to be, you know, apocalyptic scenes, right? I think the question is, are we up for a world in which all of our institutions are under assault? Because those institutions were built on a certain relationship to the environment, and that environment is rapidly changing. And so what seems like it's a problem of climate, which is it's a problem outside of us in the weather, is actually going to manifest itself as a problem in our political institutions. And the question is whether or not we are up to the challenge of building firewalls around all of those existing political institutions, instead of pretending like, well, climate change is going to be resolved over there in the UNFCCC, like that the Paris story is the story that we have to concentrate on, instead of, no, wait, maybe we should have a migration policy globally that makes sense, and domestically that makes sense, and thinking about those things as climate problems instead of as political or economic problems, which they are, but our political and economic system is premised upon climate change. So just to get back to the question, we have a tendency when we think about climate change to displace our thinking onto these abstract categories like, oh yeah, there's going to be an island that is destroyed, and we can get ourselves suitably like worked up about that, and we should be able to get ourselves suitably worked up about that. But the fact of the matter is that lulls us into a sense that where climate change is going to be and where the negative catastrophe of climate change is going to be over there, right? But it's not. It's going to be inside the U.S. It's going to be at the borders of the U.S. It's going to be inside Europe. It's going to be at the borders of Europe. It's going to be inside China. It's going to be at the borders of China. And I think that the sooner that countries already know this. That's why they care. That doesn't make the political problems of cooperation any easier. It doesn't make the solution any easier. But it does sort of, you know, I think that's the big change that's come out of the IPCC 1.5 report, is that it's quite clear that this is not going to manifest itself outside, but rather inside our current societies.
So, Professor, you are speaking to, I mean, right now in this podcast, like, the people who are listening are ambitious college-age students. What should we be doing? What fields of research should we be going into to do our best to, you know, combat the crisis that we're in?
I mean, that's a really good question. So I think, again, the tendency is to be like, well, what we need to do is make our life's work environmental work or something like that. But again, I don't think that that's the right approach. I think if I'm consistent, what I would say is, don't like drop everything and become a climate person. No, like keep the things that you're passionate about, but learn about how the things that you're passionate about are already bound up with the environment and with climate change. And that could be in ways that you might not understand as being obvious, right? So if you care about migration, which is an example I've used, you know, let's look at the relationship between changing climate and migration. Let's look at the Syrian crisis in relation to global climate change, which caused 6 million refugees to show up in Europe and the Middle East. You know, those are the kind of things that I think are important. And I think also, again, like, there's nothing that you can and should be doing on climate change that you shouldn't be doing as citizens of this country anyway, which is to say to be politically active, not just in voting, but also in making your voices heard to your congressional representatives, to organizing communities so that they are able to have voice for the things that they want, outreach to the communities that you don't normally talk to. Things that I think of as just like basic political work of what it means to be a citizen in this country, those are the things that people should be doing anyway. And to fold environment into that, to see how environmental and climate change issues are constitutive of these things that we tend to think of as being outside our normal everyday life, and to make them inside our normal everyday life, to me, that's the challenge. The challenge is, how do we incorporate all of these things directly into the lives that we live, rather than treating it like it's a special project or it's something that we have to devote our lives to or whatever, because our lives are our lives and we have to find the way to do it.
That's great. And I mean, I guess to finish up here as well, what do you think is the future of global climate governance? And how do you think it's going to look like? And if you were to guess, do you think we will reach the goal of curbing emissions to 1.5 Celsius by 2100 or 2100?
Well, so I talked a little bit about this already. I guess I would say that, you know, the Conference of the Parties to the UNFCCC is meeting in a couple weeks' time in Poland. And the key challenge at that particular conference is to come up with a roadmap for basically enacting Paris, because Paris is meant to go into effect in 2020. So really soon, like in 14 months. And, you know, I think we'll get a lot of information in Poland as to whether or not there's sufficient political will to make anything close to 1.5 happen. Okay, so I've already said we're going to blow by 1.5. The question is, how far past 1.5 are we going? And crucially, how long do we spend above 1.5 degrees Celsius warming? Because that's a crucial thing that we don't talk about enough as well. It's not just that we're gonna go over 1.5, it's how long are we gonna be above 1.5? Because every year that we spend above 1.5 degrees is another year in which we destroy ecosystems, shift organizational reproduction, shift sea levels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in ways that could create irreversible outcomes. So it's not, are we going to go above 1.5? It's how long are we going to be above there? And we're not really going to know that until Paris gets going. And we don't even really know if Paris is going to get going on a good footing until after the Conference of the Parties in Poland. I was looking, before I came in here, I was looking at the negotiating text that they're bringing to Poland, and it's a mess. So they're going to have 2 weeks to get a 370-page document, you know, down to probably 100 workable pages, which is not going to be easy. If they do it, it'll be a huge signal that there's a political commitment to deal with the problem. If they don't, then we're kind of back into a pre-Paris space where nobody really knows what this looks like. And I think there's a real risk of that. And the reason why I think there's a real risk of that is because Obama has been replaced by Trump, and America is not going to be a leader in Poland next week. Macron is still in charge of France, but he's very weak domestically. Merkel is still involved, is still the head of the German government, but she's obviously in a weakened domestic position. China is still led by Xi Jinping. He seems to be pretty personally committed to the issue, so I expect, you know, his support to be more or less constant. But they were never really a pusher in the sense that they were never really going around and cajoling other states to increase their commitments. They always advocate for flexibility and for countries to accomplish their goals in coordination with their national sovereignty. And then, of course, in Brazil, which was also brought into the Paris Agreement, was a crucial signatory to the Paris Agreement. And even more than that, just as a party to accede before the Paris was signed, to sort of signal to other developing countries that big developing countries like China and Brazil were on board with this, you know, played a key role. And now, you know, Bolsonaro has been elected in Brazil. He's going to eliminate the Ministry of the Environment. And clearly, you know, Brazil is going to go from a willing participant to a dragger. And that's going to negatively affect things. So if you look at the coalition that made Paris happen, you know, not too many members of that coalition are in good domestic positions or even around anymore. And so where's leadership for Poland going to come from? I mean, Paris was kind of seen as a miracle. And I already told you it wasn't like a crazy hard treaty to negotiate, right? It was like, wait, I have an idea. We're all going to get together and we're going to make a pledge and then we're going to review those pledges. And everyone's like, yeah, let's do it. But that took so much work just to get that. And in fact, a lot of people would accredit skilled French diplomacy to making that happen, because the French president and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in France made it their mission to make sure that Paris was going to be a success. Now, where is this COP being hosted? It's in Poland. Poland has been a dragger on climate always. So they're not going to like be investing a lot of energy in making sure that the diplomatic wheels are heavily greased the way that France was. Next year, the Conference of the Parties, which will be the Conference of the Parties just before Paris goes into effect, it's going to be in Brazil. So we're going to be presented with this spectacle of a COP taking place in Bolsonaro's Brazil, which I can only imagine is going to be chaotic at best, right? Now, thankfully, the UNFCCC is usually at least a little bit insulated from the up and down of everyday politics. But that's only because it's dealt with in the Ministry of Environments. If Brazil doesn't have a Ministry of the Environment, then who's going to coordinate the conference for Brazil? It's not even clear to me what's going to happen. Okay, so we're going to blow by 1.5. How many years are we going to spend above 1.5 is the question. We'll find out more about that in a couple of weeks. And you can have me back next year. And I can, you know, either give you the optimistic or the pessimistic story again.
Oh, man.
Talk a little bit about the upcoming Brazilian COP next year.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
We're 10 days away from catastrophe.
Yeah, I'll just take it to an even more grandiose level next year, yeah.
Well, we want to thank you for coming in, Professor. This was a truly amazing podcast as well, and we learned a lot.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.